You're listening to audio from Cities Church. You can find more resources and learn about our ministry by visiting citieschurch.com.
We are living in an increasingly shaming society. The internet, no doubt, has made it easier than ever to shame someone in public. It has never taken so little effort to shame someone else in the eyes of so many people as we can do today with modern media, perhaps especially this thing we call social media. The Cambridge Dictionary now defines the word shaming as the act of publicly criticizing and drawing attention to someone, especially on the internet. It's in the dictionary definition. So the internet may make it easier than ever to publicly criticize someone or draw negative attention to someone, but surely online is not the only context for our society's new penchant for shaming. It can happen on your block. It can happen in your building. It could be gossip. It could be outright comments. It can happen at work or in your extended family. And ironically, as our society becomes more and more shameless about the things that we used to consider sin and taboo, we increasingly try to shame those who now live by the standards that previous generations once had. Shame is a painful emotion that you feel in the presence of others for not living up to their expectations, whether those are good expectations or bad. And the intentional effort to bring shame upon someone in public is not new to the 21st century. It may feel kind of new in Western society. It's not new around the world, and it's not new at all in the history of the world. 2,000 years ago, the Romans, as many of you know, employed a brutal method of execution that not only slowly suffocated the victims with literally excruciating pain, but did so up on trees in prominent public places for all to see, with the subjects stripped naked to maximize both the physical and the emotional pain. We sang a few minutes ago about that rugged cross. Some of you know there's an old hymn about the rugged cross. That's where that new hymn's drawing it from. It goes like this: on a hill far away from America, not far away from the Middle East, on a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, an emblem of suffering and shame. The New Testament knows this. Hebrews 12:2 says that Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame. And in a twist of gospel irony, Paul writes in Colossians 2:15 that at the cross, God disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in Jesus. So Jesus was put to shame on the cross, but God had the final word and conquered Satan and his minions through the cross and instead put them to open shame. Our text this morning is one of the most famous in all the Gospels. Anyone who would follow Jesus must deny himself and take up his cross, take up the emblem of suffering and shame. It is so easy to domesticate this call today, when we wear crosses around our necks and use crosses for decor. We're prone to receive Jesus' word either as an extreme call to literally die, or, on the other hand, the minor inconveniences of life to try to endure those without too much complaining. But the cross is the single most horrible form of suffering and shamed devised in the history of human wickedness. When Jesus said to his disciples, "Take up your cross," these were shocking words. At first, it was imponderable to the disciples that their master who they now believe to be Israel's long-awaited Messiah and rightful king, could be made to suffer and be so shamed as to be hoisted up on a cross in public? And then imagine the disciples thinking about the shame that would be brought upon them. They left everything to follow this guy. And shame would come upon them as Jesus was hoisted up at the busiest intersection in town for all to see. So the question then for the disciples, and the question for us today, is what does it mean to take up your cross? How do we do that? And why? Why would we want to take up perhaps history's single greatest deterrent, as the Romans used it? So to answer those questions this morning, I think it comes together for us in a single charge for us as a church, and it comes in three parts. So single charge, three parts. Here's number one, and here's the charge. Embrace shame for Jesus' sake. Embrace shame for Jesus' sake. This is verse 34. Look at verse 34. Jesus says, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Now, as you said, the cross is not only an instrument of suffering and death, but also of shame. And the reason that I'm emphasizing shame here this morning, embrace shame, is not because the cross isn't about suffering and death. It manifestly is. Jesus says, when he says, lose this life, death is in view. But this passage does bring shame into particular focus in a way that I hadn't seen until now, and I guess in a way that many of us haven't seen until now. Maybe we're distracted by the death aspect and maybe oversee the shame aspect of what Jesus has to say. So what we're going to see in verses 31 to 33, that's going to put an accent on shame. And then verse 38 makes shame explicit. Look down at verse 38. "Whoever is ashamed of me," Jesus says, "and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father and with the holy angels." So shame is explicitly on the table here as we close out the first part of Mark and launch into the second half, as Jonathan talked about. There's more to say in a minute here about verse 38. But let's have shame in view with Jesus' charge this morning to the crowds, to the disciples, and to us to embrace shame. But don't think Jesus would have us embrace any kind of shame. He specifies for us. He has a particular kind of shame in mind. In verse 38, he gives a particular cause for the shame. "Whoever is ashamed," he says, "of me and of my words." And he's going to say in verse 35 that this is for his sake and for the gospel's. So Jesus' sake and the gospel's sake and his word's sake is the righteous cause for which he calls us to embrace shame that others would seek to heap upon us because of him. There's a righteous shame that we should feel when we sin, when we misrepresent Jesus to our watching world. But this, that we're talking about here in Mark 8, is the unrighteous shame that the enemies of Christ and his cross would seek to heap on us because of our allegiance to Jesus and his words. That's what Jesus says in the Gospels. That's the entirety of the gospel. That's what his apostles have to say. That's what his prophets and apostles together have to say. It would be considered his words. So God's charge to us this morning is to embrace shame for Jesus' sake. He warns us to be ready to be shamed in this world. And he gets us ready by turning our perspective upside down. He wants to turn our mindset upside down. He wants to give us new expectations of what life in this world should be like for those of us who follow Jesus. So the what is embrace shame for Jesus' sake. And then now the how. This is number two. Number one, embrace shame for Jesus' sake. But secondly, here's the how, through crucified expectations. Through crucified expectations. This is verses 22 to 33. This is the bulk of the passage. It's where we come to the heart, come to this great transition between part one of Mark, now into part two. The key contrast comes in verse 33. Maybe the most important verse in this gospel so far. It's the most important verse in this passage. Look at verse 33. It's what Jesus says to Peter. You are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. The issue, Jesus says, is a certain mindset, setting your mind, or a certain perspective, or certain expectations. And verse 33 is not just the hinge of this passage, but of the whole Gospel of Mark. This is the transition. All eight chapters of Mark so far have been leading up to this. Jesus, as we've seen, has been carefully revealing himself to his disciples, that he's more than just a healer, he's more than just a gifted teacher. We saw it again 2 weeks ago, how the disciples have been so slow to understand. But now here, at the hinge of the book, and the precise seam is probably verses 30 to 31. Right in there, that's the precise seam where Jesus has revealed to them, he's the Messiah, they know he's the Messiah, but now he needs to change their perspective, recalibrate their expectations on what it means for him to be Messiah. So now, he's going to take steps to teach them what it means that he's Messiah. Not in their expectations, but in the mindset of God, according to the things of God. Remember where this is going in verse 34. Take up your cross. That's where it's headed. That's where Jesus is going. Take up your cross. And the key in verse 33 is our setting our minds on the things of God, not on the things of man. But to understand what Jesus means by that, setting your mind on things of God, not things of man, we need to walk through the rest of this passage. So here's how we're going to do it. First, we'll circle back to verses 27 to 30. Then we'll go back further, very briefly, to 22 to 26. And then finally, we'll come back here to verses 31 to 32. So look back to verses 27 to 30. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? And they told him, John the Baptist. And others say, Elijah. And others, one of the prophets. And he asked them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered him, you are the Christ. And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. So, at long last, the disciples are catching on. All the parables, all the healings, all the teaching, they're starting to get it. Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah, the Christ. And Peter now, representing the 12, confesses this to Jesus. You're the Christ. And it's true. It's a step forward in Jesus' development with the disciples. Jesus is no mere prophet, as some think. Rather, he's the one to whom all the prophets have been pointing. And this is God's work that the disciples are catching on. In the Gospel of Matthew, in the same story, Jesus says to Peter, blessed are you, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you. Humanity did not reveal this to you. You did not think this up. You didn't get this on your own. But my Father, who is in heaven, revealed this to you. This is a gift. This is a work of God that the disciples are coming to the point to see Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah, not another prophet, but the one to whom all the prophets have pointed. However, something's still missing here, because we have this strange refrain again about Jesus strictly charging them not to say anything. What in the world? Now they know he's the Messiah. And the first thing he says is, don't tell anybody. Verse 30, he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And if you've been with us throughout the series, you've seen this over and over. Chapter 1, verses 43 to 44, Jesus heals a leper. And then he sternly charged him and sent him away at once and said to him, see that you say nothing to anyone. Chapter 3, verses 11 to 12. Whenever the unclean spirits saw Jesus, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. Chapter 5, verse 43. After Jesus raised the 12-year-old girl from the dead, he strictly charged them, the family, that no one should know this. And then, as we saw last time, chapter 7, verse 36, Jesus healed a deaf man, and he charged them to tell no one. Over and over again, he's saying, don't spread the word yet. We've talked about this before in our series, about the messianic secret. And that Jesus does not encourage the spreading yet of the story while it's still incomplete. When he finishes a healing, the story's not done yet. The healing's about him. And the story is still unfolding. We're going to see it again next week in Mark 9:9, after the transfiguration. Even after confessing him to be the Christ, even after this teaching about what it means to be the Messiah, even after seeing Jesus transfigured before them in glory on the mountaintop, the story is not yet completed. There's a cross to come to. There's a resurrection to be experienced. Jesus knows that the disciples do not yet know what it means for him to be Messiah. They have human expectations. They are setting their minds on the things of man. And so Jesus begins to teach them in Mark 8:31 here that God's Messiah is on a different path than expected. This is huge because it's not just about Jesus. It's about the disciples. It's also about his church. So Mark 8:31, he teaches them there's a cross to come for this Messiah. One chapter later, Mark 9:31, there's a cross to come for this Messiah. And they're not getting it. They're so slow to understand. Then chapter 10, verse 33, there's a cross to come for this Messiah. 8:31, 9:31, 10:33. Three times he says it plainly, explicitly. He doesn't want them to mention it. This is a hard truth to come into. Our human expectations for God's long-awaited Messiah are so different than the reality of what God has thought and planned. It takes a while to come into this reality, to come into these new crucified expectations. Which takes us back to verses 22 to 26. You heard Jeff read that about healing this blind man in two stages. Very strange. Why heal the blind man in two stages? Jesus has the power to do it all at once. We've seen him do it all at once, over and over again. It's not like Jesus needs to give it a start and then come back and catch his breath and give it a second effort. He does this over and over again with every healing. Every other healing has been on the spot, immediate, and full. And now, he heals him in two stages. Why do it that way? He's helping his disciples. This is a lived-out parable. All the healings have been teaching about him. All the healings have been parables in some sense. And this one is especially for the disciples and for us. He's even queued it up in verses 17 and 18 and 21 by saying, "Do you disciples not yet perceive? Do you not yet understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes," there's the key here to healing the blind man, "having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear?" Verse 21, "Do you not yet understand?" So Jesus is showing the disciples that they are like the blind man. They need a two-stage healing. Being healed to find out that Jesus is the Messiah is not enough. We need to have the right kind of Messiah in mind, with the right crucified expectation, setting our minds on the things of God, not on the things of man. Now back to verses 30 and 31. 31 to 33. I'll read those. "Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly." And Peter, setting his mind on the things of man, different expectations, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan." For, here's the explanation, it's an important word, for. We'll see this in a minute. Because you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. So Peter and the disciples now confess Jesus as Christ, but they don't yet understand. Jesus is indeed the Messiah. He is the Christ. He's no mere prophet. But God's Messiah will be crucified. He will triumph. He will come into his glory. But on the way to conquering, he himself will be conquered. He will walk in the path of suffering and shame. And his people will walk with him in his steps. In other words, they will follow him. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Verse 34. So Peter's paradigm, let me lay it out for you as explicitly as I can. Peter's paradigm, thinking in the way of man, goes like this. Jesus is the Christ. Therefore, he will not die. Therefore, we will triumph with him. He's my Lord. He's the Christ. I'm with him. He's the Christ. We're safe. He's going to triumph, and we're going straight to glory together. But Jesus' paradigm, which he's now introducing to his disciples with his mind set on the things of God, goes like this. Jesus says, I'm the Christ. Therefore, I will be shamed for the sake of my people. And I will rise in glory and in honor, and my people too will be shamed with me, and then rise with me in glory and in honor. Jesus, as Messiah, as God's Son, has security in his identity that produces the ability to make costly sacrifices for the sake of others. Because of his identity in God, because he knows he's Messiah, because his feet are firmly secure on the rock of who God is, he's able to make sacrifice. He's able to embrace the cost, embrace the shame for the sake of others. He's not an insecure Messiah. He's secure. He can embrace the cost himself and the shame himself for the good of others. Peter was right about the end, that there would be honor for Jesus and those who follow him, but Peter was not right about the means. Peter was not yet ready to embrace the shame of coming after Jesus. He was still thinking naturally. He was setting his mind on things of man. So now that we've heard the charge, embrace shame for Jesus' sake. And now that we have the means, number two here, through crucified expectations, now finally we come to the motivation. This is so sweet. I'm so glad that Jesus is a Savior like this. Number three, for the greater gain of being unashamed with Jesus forever. Verses 35 to 38. Embrace shame for Jesus' sake, through crucified expectations. Number three, for the greater gain of being unashamed with Jesus forever. Now there are four fours in this last paragraph, right? F-O-U-R, four, F-O-R-S, fours. Like the word because. Four becauses that bring together a very tight reasoning and rationale and appeal from Jesus to us. Let me read those for you, and then we'll come back and briefly look at each one, take them apart, and put them back together, and be done. So look again at verses 34 to 38. After talking to his disciples, now he calls the crowd to him with his disciples, and he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Verse 35, for, because, whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and for the gospel's will save it. Verse 36, for what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? 37, 4. What can a man give in return for his soul? Verse 38, 4. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father and with the holy angels. All right, I know that's dense. You're not probably going to get it on the first pass. So let's take them one at a time, try to paraphrase them, and put them back together. And actually, what we're going to do at the end here, we're going to flip them upside down. Instead of saying reason, four, 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 we're going to flip it and say this at the bottom, therefore, therefore, therefore. Work back through it to see it from another angle, see if that's helpful for you. Verse 35 is the trickiest of these four verses because it's got a wordplay in it. The Greek word for soul or life, psyche, we get our word psychology from it. And so it can mean soul, it can mean life. Both of those could be translated in that way. And so there's kind of Jesus kind of gives it a double meaning here. He's talking about the soul or life in two senses. There's life in this world, and then there's life forever. There's a kind of life that's being denied, and a kind of life that's being pursued or gained. Let me paraphrase verse 35 for you in light of those two different uses of this word life or soul. Whoever would save his life in this world will lose his life forever. But whoever loses his life in this world for my sake and the gospel's will save his life forever. In other words, given the fallen nature of our world, the predicament that we're already in, given the mission of Jesus to save his people from the situation that we're in of sin and death, God's people are not on a straight, comfortable, shameless path to glory. That's not an option anymore. Our lives are being saved forever, but the pathway to ultimate saving runs through embracing loss in the here and now. The pathway to being finally unashamed forever with Jesus runs through being shamed now in this world for Jesus' sake. That's the argument of verse 35. Now verse 36. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? That's a rhetorical question. The answer is nothing. It doesn't gain you anything. It does not profit at all to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul. It is an utterly tragic loss. And since we're talking about shame, I think we should hear in this phrase, gain the whole world, don't think about possessions. Think about applause. Don't think about revenue in this world. Think about respect in this world. Don't think about earthly estates. Think about earthly esteem. Brothers and sisters, it is not worth saving face in this world and going soft on Jesus and his words and his gospel. It does not profit anything. Verse 37, for what can a man give in return for his soul? Another rhetorical question. Answer, nothing. You cannot swap any amount of respect from your neighbors, from your coworkers, from people on social media in this world in return for your eternal soul. You cannot trade all your hard-earned acceptance with others here for what matters most in the universe, God's embrace. All right, so let's do it backwards. I said we'd flip it around and do it backwards. So we go verse 37, and the opposite of a because or a for is therefore. You go backwards. We'll start verse 37. We'll say therefore, therefore, therefore. Work our way back up. Verse 37. You can just listen to my paraphrase if you want, instead of getting lost in different words. You cannot trade earthly acceptance for what matters most, your soul. Verse 36. Therefore, it is not to your benefit to gain the world's acceptance and lose God's. Verse 35. Therefore, in saving your life in this world from shame, you lose what matters most. And in losing your life here by embracing shame for Jesus' sake, you find it forever. Jesus' whole argument here is an appeal to our desire. This is what's such good news. Jesus does not say, forsake your desires, do your duty. He argues that we will be happier. In the end, we will have what we want most and we will have it forever. We will be happier if we do not cower to this world's effort to shame us into the slavery of its submission. How astounding that Jesus makes an appeal to our desire at this point. He could simply say, I'm God, do what I say. But he seeks to win our obedience from the heart. He captures our inner person as a way of transforming our outer person. He gives us reasons. He gives us rationale. He makes his case, and at bottom is an appeal to our deepest and our most enduring joy, rather than treating us like mere creatures of duty. So when Jesus bids us follow me, he does not call us to die to real joy, but to find it. We end here on verse 38. This is the final thing to say. And this verse 38 now comes in support of all of verses 34 to 37. So it doesn't flow through the chain in the same way by just supporting the previous verse. It goes back now to verse 34 and supports the whole section. For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. So in our call this morning to embrace shame for Jesus' sake, don't misunderstand. Shame is not an end in itself. It will lead to honor. God's Messiah didn't go straight to glory, but he went through the cross, but he does indeed come in glory. First, he walks the path of shame. Then he comes into his glory. And the same is true for his bride, the church. So when we talk about self-denial today, what does self-denial mean in Christianity? Does it mean that we're called to self-denial? Increasingly, it will be more and more like the first century. There were some who suffered physically. There were even some who died. It doesn't seem to be our main concern as a church at the moment. But few, if any of us, will escape the world's efforts at trying to shame us. But Jesus makes his appeal to our hearts. Embrace shame for my sake. Don't cower when the world tries to do this to you. Embrace shame through crucified expectations and do so for the sake of deeper and enduring joy in Jesus. As we come to the table here, I remind you again of Hebrews 12, verse 2, that for the joy set before him, Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame. Jesus reversed the shame of the cross by making it into an honor for him and his people, and by putting his enemies to open shame, Colossians 2:15. And so this table here this morning is an invitation to shame and to honor, to both, in a certain order. We are a people who move from shame to honor rather than from honor to shame. If you eat and drink with us here this morning, saying, Jesus is my Lord, Jesus is my Savior, he's my treasure, it is only a matter of time before our increasingly shaming society sets its targets upon you and upon this church. But when it does, We are in this together. We eat together. We stand together. Alone, you may be caught off guard. You may not be expecting it. All of a sudden, somebody's trying to shame me. Better give in. Better cave. But we're not alone. We're together. We stand ready to remind ourselves what we stand for. Not for silly mistakes. Apologize for those. But for Jesus and His words and His gospel. We're ready for this. Let's stand our ground together. We will gladly suffer shame for His name. Because our being shamed will not be the end of the story. Just as Jesus being shamed was not the end of His story. And He is coming in glory. When He does, what matters most is that we would stand unashamed with Him. Ask the guys to come, servers, the band, come to the table. As we distribute these elements, we're going to sing a song that is kind of the sung version of the text we've been looking at this morning. It's one of my favorites. Just about every time I preach, I ask Nick to do this song. But this time, the text actually matches up with the song. This is one of my favorites. In particular, this is the second verse. It goes like this. Hear how this pairs with the call this morning to embrace shame for Jesus' sake. Let the world despise and leave me. Maybe say shame. Let the world despise and shame me. They have shamed my Savior too. Human hearts and looks deceive me. Thou art not like man untrue. Oh, while thou dost smile upon me. God of wisdom, love, and might, foes may hate and friends may shun me. Show thy face, and all is bright. So this morning, if you'd say, Jesus is my Lord, He's my Savior, He's my treasure, I'm so glad He was willing to be shamed for me that I might partake of His grace. And I want to stand together with God's people, come what may, come what efforts our society makes to shame us and make us cower. We stand together and we stand in Him. We'd invite you to eat with us. We'll distribute the elements first. We'll hold the bread. We'll eat together, then distribute the cup. His body is the true bread. Let us serve you.